This is Monocle on Design, Monocle's weekly show dedicated to the best in architecture, industrial design, graphics and fashion. I'm Josh Fennett. Coming up today.
800 years ago, the craftsmen and the carpenters who built the roof were working really at the cutting edge of their technology at that time.
We ask whether fire-damaged Notre Dame's renovation should look to scale new heights or simply replace what was destroyed in the first place. Plus,
this to me is the sexiest building on the planet, and it was like inspiring, amazing, but also humbling, because to be restrained in this condition was something that really was an amazing design challenge and an opportunity.
A golden age modernist building that sparkled with the optimism of the jet age receives a new lease of life as a hotel. We deliver the verdict on the TWA Hotel, originally designed by Eero Saarinen. All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design on Monocle 24. Do stay tuned, won't you?
Une épaisse fumée s'échappe de la cathédrale Notre-Dame. On aperçoit des flammes.
First up this week, we react to a decision made by the French Senate. It recently suggested that the fire-devastated Notre-Dame Cathedral in Paris should be rebuilt entirely as was. But is it a shame to snub the outpouring of new ideas and optimism about updating this beloved building? How might the space be used to better reflect the cities of today? Well, with me to discuss the age-old conundrum of whether to reuse or redo is Professor Alan Dunlop. He's an architect and the fellow of the Royal Incorporation of Architects in Scotland and an alumnus of the Glasgow School of Art. Does the destruction of Notre Dame offer any opportunity for improvement? A terrible disaster, but there's obviously a silver lining in there, perhaps, for the architecturally minded.
I think it should offer an opportunity for a forward-looking country facing into the 21st century. And I applauded the Prime Minister and Macron, even though there was doubt over whether they could produce it in time for the Olympics, when they suggested they might consider an alternative to a replication of what was there originally, and consider even a new build project. So that I thought that was very brave of them, and I applauded that. I'm a bit dismayed that the Senate have now come out and said that you have to be replicated as it was prior to the fire, which seems to me to be a bit bizarre and a bit disappointing, but also a bit absurd, given that the majority of the timber that was burnt during the course of the fire was not seen from the inside of the interior. So it was a 12th century technology that they would be replicating that would not be seen. So not only was it disappointing that the Senate came out with this point of view, but I think also absurd, considering that the structural work that was destroyed during the course of the fire would not be seen anyway. So I couldn't understand why they couldn't replicate that in a modern, contemporary way.
I'm completely with you, and the thing that strikes me is actually it's a rather poignant time for architecture. You see this outpouring of joy, this outpouring of respect and real feeling for a building that wasn't built by the people who are observing it today. I wonder when you looked at those designs, some a bit absurd, some perhaps a bit fanciful, what, if any of them, caught your eye about the ideas floated by architects to redo the spire?
Well, I was first of all impressed at how quickly some architects managed to produce what was quite a convincing three-dimensional image, Norman Foster in particular. And there was some, frankly, quite absurd proposal for that, and that maybe caused the Senate to, you know, underline the fact that it should be rebuilt as normal, but as before the fire. But I thought that Ian Ritchie in particular made a good suggestion of how you might actually reconstruct the roof and the spire in a contemporary way. So his stood out, I think, as amongst the best of the very early propositions for how you might do it. But there was what some might consider to be absurd ideas, but, you know, interesting that are worth a kind of second thought. And one was actually included the redesign of the roof as an internal garden space for the people of Paris. The interesting thing, well, I mean, Notre Dame is an extremely important building, obviously, not only for France, but for the whole of Europe and internationally. But it wasn't necessarily considered just to be a secular building. People who weren't Christians or secular in any kind of way understood that the building truly was the heart of Paris. So you didn't have to be religious to think that this is a really important building that had to be treated seriously. So that was the incredibly disappointing thing about the fire also, you know.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree with you, and I love this idea that a building, no matter what its purpose, could continue to serve a new and manifold purposes that reflect the way that we live and the way that society has changed, because Lord knows that building's been added to over time anyway to create what it was. I'd like to, if I may, draw on your deep well of architectural knowledge to ask about some historic examples of buildings, perhaps, that were destroyed in the past, but have been given new life, a new lease of life, by some great architectural minds. I'm going to direct you, perhaps, at the beginning, towards Berlin.
Right. Well, the most outstanding example of what has been recreated from an old building has been created in Berlin, at Museum Island in Berlin, the Neues Museum. And that was destroyed by bombers, obviously, as many of those things in Germany were. A building created by Friedrich Stuhler in 1859, but bombed to ruins, with entire sections missing by the Allies during the course of the Second World War. David Chipperfield won a competition for rebuilding a major part of it and renewing the galleries. And working with Julian Harrop, he took on the restoration work. But the interesting thing about that, and a kind of guide, I think, about how to go about restoring buildings like this, was he made a clear decision that you would be able to read quite distinctly what was the old building and what was the new building. But the interventions and the additions that have been added to by Chipperfield and Harrop, although are unmistakably contemporary, harmonise and fit in and sympathetic to the original building in mass and scale. So the prime example of how you do that successfully would be the Neues Museum in Berlin and by David Chipperfield, and I think that was an extending example. The interesting thing about that, if you've got time, is that you may know that the Glasgow School of Art photographs are recently published about the damaged interior. Now, it looked from the photographs that some of the major walls were actually left standing, and it wasn't completely destroyed as originally had thought. Now, I think the Neues Museum and how that was actually handled, the reintroduction of the new art school into the old building and making a distinct definition between what was new, Macintosh's original, and what would be the new additions to it, is perhaps a way forward for how we might actually do this Glasgow School of Art rather than just completely replicating the Macintosh design.
And Alan, there's a bit of a sliding scale to be observed as well. I'm thinking of places, I suppose, like the site of the World Trade Center towers, which were kind of remaster planned by Daniel Libeskind. The absence there of a building and a kind of the creation of a well and a space to look at where a building once stood is sometimes, you could argue, as powerful absence as presence. What do you think of that as an idea, to kind of leave space for people to project onto it what they want?
Well, I think that's incredibly important. But I think there has to be a determination. There also has to be a discipline as to, and an explanation, a plausible narrative as to the reason why you're doing that. I think the first point that you had made about buildings, I don't think there's anything like a building which actually characterises or captures a kind of nation's history and past history and everything they've gone through like a building does. There's no other art form, I think, is managed to actually capture that in a way that a building actually does. perhaps there's not quite such a feeling that they had to replicate the Twin Towers, because I don't think they had that degree of likeableness that the Notre Dame actually has, being an older building. So I think it depends very strongly on the narrative and the story that you tell about how you actually go further forward with the project.
Absolutely. And I'm going to bring you now, not to be too depressing, but onto maybe some of the failures of reconstruction. I'm thinking of the city of Rotterdam. I'm even thinking of a trip I made fairly recently to Warsaw, where a lot of the buildings are artifice. They were pieced together from paintings after that city was bombed. And maybe they don't tick everyone's boxes today. It's not without risk, is it, that we undertake rebuilding things?
Well, whether you replicate or rebuild as new or look to actually reconstruct as it was, for me, it's absolutely a matter of a question of authenticity. And you're absolutely right to mention old Warsaw. I mean, that was 85% of that was destroyed during the Warsaw Uprising at the Second World War. And the people of Warsaw took, after 5 years, the reconstruction campaign. They started a meticulous reconstruction of what was the old town centre, including the reconstruction of churches and palaces and the marketplaces and all the civic spaces. And they did that as a gesture of confidence, you know, for people who had been devastated by what had actually happened to their city during the Second World War itself and its destruction. And they did that to a degree with authenticity through the use of paintings and whatever information they had based on 14th and 15th century structure itself. And they've done it extremely well. It's an incredibly popular tourist destination, but it's not authentic. But nevertheless, it's incredibly popular, and the people of Warsaw love it. So it's a deeply interesting philosophical point of view, you know, whether you consider this to be something which is not authentic and so therefore, you know, has not a great degree of authenticity to it, or whether you think it's because it's popularity through tourism and it's given people back confidence that it was a worthwhile thing to do. Rotterdam, in contrast, is quite different. That was a building, that was a town centre also destroyed by Nazi bombers during the course of the Second World War. They take a completely different attitude towards that. They rebuilt that using high-profile architectural projects because very little of the town centre had actually remained. Now, they had brought in some tremendous architects to rebuild as new, Marcel Breuer including in them, and they have some great architecture, particularly housing by people like Rem Koolhaas. But, you know, if you visit Rotterdam, you know, there's a kind of soullessness about it, it seems to me. Although there is incredibly interesting and innovative new architectural projects, it does not have the degree of interest, and there is a soullessness about it, and there's a coldness about what's actually happened in Rotterdam in comparison to Warsaw. So it is a deeply philosophical debate about whether you consider that to be the replication to be a worthwhile thing, or whether you should actually go for rebuilding as new.
You're so right, and there are so many things to consider when going into that. I was thinking just before this interview about, I suppose, how food halls are examples of old buildings often that are being turned to new use and being allowed to kind of recharge the street life around them. But Notre Dame is a little bit different from that in my mind. It's one of those rare places in a city today where, regardless of your religious outlook, you are encouraged to be reflective, to sit and perhaps, you know, attempt whatever you consider to be spiritual, which there aren't that many spaces for in cities. I'm going to ask you, Alan, if I gave you carte blanche to do anything with Notre Dame, if I gave you the project here and now, what kind of considerations would you make with it?
Well, I would unequivocally go towards a contemporary addition to the roof and a new spire, absolutely. Just exactly how the form that that would take would be developed over a period of time. But you have to remember that 800 years ago, the craftsmen and the carpenters who built the roof were working really at the cutting edge of their technology at that time. The spans that they had to create to cover the kind of central space of Notre Dame itself, and the engineering required and carpentry required for that was extraordinary, and as I say, right at the very cutting edge of their time. I think that we have an obligation as architects, but also for people in the 21st century, to take a similar kind of attitude towards it and build something which is absolutely contemporary and forward-looking rather than something which just looks back to the past. And I think that 800 years ago, if any of those people who built the building were still alive or they could have a view of this, they would take exactly the same attitude towards that. You build right to the very edge of your technology, especially with a building like Notre Dame. I mean, the Seine carries the lifeblood of Paris, but Notre Dame is its heart, and you can't visit the city of Paris without actually visiting Notre Dame. And you don't have to be spiritual, you don't have to be religious to enjoy the whole ambience of the place and sit underneath it and sit within its gardens. But I would take an absolutely contemporary attitude towards it rather than try to build something which is, you know, represents what actually happened in the past. And I think also that the Duke who built the spire would also take that attitude as well. When he built the spire, he didn't want to build it as it had been 800 years ago. He worked to the very edge of his technology too and managed to create something which was absolutely remarkable. I think we would do exactly the same.
And my many and varied thanks to Professor Alan Dunlop. He's an architect and a fellow of the Royal Incorporation of Architects in Scotland. Thank you so much, Alan. Next, we sent our America's editor-at-large, Ed Stocker, to the opening of a hotel in the TWA Flight Centre, a curvaceous new affair at John F. Kennedy International Airport. And the space? Oh, just a gem designed by the mid-century maestro Eero Saarinen. With two contemporary new builds containing over 500 bedrooms, available overnight or for just a few hours, for what reasons we'll leave to your imagination, might this ambitious new hotel help make aviation all the more glamorous again? And do people even want to stay at JFK anyway, an airport with a piss-poor reputation at best? The TWA Hotel is being heralded as the first step of better things to come, however. Last year, New York State announced $13 billion to transform the airport between now and 2025. Ed spoke with three key firms involved in the new hotel's design, and here is his report.
Now, for many years, I used to come out of Terminal 5 right here at JFK Airport, where JetBlue has its fleet, and stare rather enviously at the mid-century masterpiece in front of me. That masterpiece was, of course, Eero Saarinen's magnificent TWA Flight Center building, which stood empty for years and years, but no longer, as tonight attests. I'm right here inside that round building on an upper gallery looking down on the lobby of what is now a hotel, the TWA Hotel, in fact. It's an unashamedly nostalgic affair, as you may be able to tell from the soundtrack playing behind me.
When I moved to New York many years ago, 1975, the first building I went to see was TWA. 20 years later, I got a call from the client, wanted us to be the preservation consultant. I was thrilled. And that's ancient history.
Richard Southwick is partner and director of historic preservation at Byatt Blinder Bell, architect of record on the TWA project.
25 years later, this building is finally open, and I couldn't be more thrilled that a building that had been dark for 19 years is now fully active. It has found a new life, which will sustain for a long, long time.
Maybe give us an idea just how long a road and how difficult a road it's been getting to where we are now.
In the 1990s, this building was almost demolished. The entire world understood how important this building was, including the owner, and they decided to save it. There was a 15-year journey to try to find a new use, and the last 5 years went into designing and building a new hotel, utilizing the historic Flight Center as the lobby and the centerpiece for the entire development.
Tell me how you approach the project from a historic preservation point of view. Tell me maybe what state the building was in and what needed doing to it.
I do what's called a X-ray glasses tour. What you see now is very similar to Saarinen's design intent from 1962. Over the ensuing decades, it had changed and been modified many, many ways. Through very rigorous detail and good craftsmanship, we've been able to bring the building back to its original state. Our role on the project was not only to restore the Flight Center, but to also orchestrate the addition of two hotel buildings and a 50,000 square feet, 5,000 square meter, underground conference center to act as a whole and to provide a number of new uses for the overall hotel.
But what of the new builds? That task went to a small Brooklyn firm, Lubrano Ciavara Architects, led by Leah Ciavara and Anne-Marie Lubrano. I started off by asking Anne-Marie how it all came about.
Back in May of 2014, we met with Tyler Morse, probably one of the most enthusiastic clients we have ever had. We met on a handshake, agreed to work together, and he said, there are basically three things you need to know. And that first thing is that Eero Saarinen is the celebrity here. The second is that I need at least 500 rooms on this site in order to pay for the restoration of the Flight Center. And the third was I need 50,000 square feet of event space because this is going to be a destination for JFK and New York City. And so for a small firm such as ours, we went back to the studio and I was like, oh my God, we cannot screw this up. It was really such an opportunity. And on opening day, I cried pretty much consecutively for 5 hours because this, to me, is the sexiest building on the planet. And for a small firm like ours to be given this commission as an opportunity to kind of tell the world who we are, it was like inspiring, amazing, but also humbling because it is such an iconic and sculptural building. And we really had to check our ego at the door. You know, we wanted to do everything we could have possibly ever dreamed of in a building. But to be restrained in this condition was something that really was an amazing design challenge and an opportunity.
Leah, you've been nodding and chuckling while Anne-Marie was answering that question. But I want to pick up on a point that Anne-Marie said, which was basically Saarinen was the superstar here. So how does that work? How does one achieve all the things that one wants to achieve with the design and architecture of a building, but then also make sure that the original 1962 building is still, in a way, I guess, the dominant part of the project?
Saarinen's building is, as Anne-Marie mentioned, such a sculptural form. When it was commissioned, it was Idlewild Airport. It wasn't JFK Airport. And Saarinen's building, the Flight Center building, was located on axis with the airport entry. And it was set against endless skyplane and endless tarmac. What struck me most about the Saarinen building is it's such a complete and whole design and whole experience. And so how do you make an addition to that kind of building? It's almost impossible, right? You can't interrupt that kind of thing. And so I think what we attempted to do was act as a foil to sort of attempt to be as singular in both concept and execution of the details in our design as Saarinen was in his, and yet to realize that in a contemporary way and really act as a foil to Saarinen and restore the figural sculptural form of his building in its entirety.
One of the most interesting things is the fact that there is a rooftop pool that looks out on the airport. People can sort of have a drink up there and have a swim and watch the planes. I'm interested to know whether people want to sort of swim in a pool and watch planes from JFK. Anne-Marie's good answer.
Absolutely. In fact, Dale Lunan, who was the project architect for our office on this, brought his three-year-old and his wife here on Sunday this weekend, and it was a glorious early summer day. And he said what was so tremendous was that it was quiet, and every time a plane was about to take off, everyone in the pool would stop and say, "It's going to happen."
Last but not least, the interiors. Michael Soumi is Principal and VP of Interior Design at Stonehill Taylor.
One of the unique aspects of designing the hotel guest rooms themselves was the fact that we have guests who may be only spending 3-4 hours in these rooms, and they are rushed and they're anxious, and we're designing for that. So everything is intuitive and easy to understand.
How true were you to 1962, the year that the original Aero Saarinen building was built? How much of that spirit of the age was incorporated into the room design? And maybe you can explain some of those little details.
Conceptually, we began and ended with 1962. Everything that we came up with, whether it was actually using Saarinen's furniture themselves or designing unique pieces for the hotel, those all had to be inspired by icons from 1962. For example, Florence Knoll, we used some of her designs as inspiration for the desk that's behind the bed. We could have taken many other things from air travel, from the history of New York City, but we pushed all those aside and really focused on Saarinen, 1962, the things that happened that year.
You said that there are going to be people here who are staying for a few hours. You can just take this room for a few hours. How does that affect design and how you lay out the room to make sure perhaps that people who have just stepped in for a few hours don't leave half their possessions behind as they rush out, for example?
If my flight's canceled, I'm not in the mood to deal with having to put things in drawers or unpack. When I get in the room, the first thing I want to do is make a stiff drink. And that's why we located the bar right there. We have hooks on the wall and counters to lay all your stuff out because you're typically going to live out of your suitcase if you're here for that short of a period of time. A great bathroom, bright lighting, amazing views, an old-fashioned telephone that we refitted, just enough stuff to entertain you while you're here for a short period of time. So TWA as a company shut down in 2001. Since we started working on this project, we've met so many former stewardesses and pilots. They all love TWA, and they love what TWA was about. I'm not sure you can say that about today's airline industry in the United States. TWA has a real sense of optimism, and we wanted to capture that optimism and happiness that we found from the staff that work with the airline.
You talk about celebrating in this age of 1962. You also said that people may not feel the same way about today's airlines. So I guess, what is this? Is it a celebration of how things used to be? How do you kind of get people excited about aviation today as they kind of look and stare at a functioning terminal, JFK's Terminal 5, where JetBlue operates from? How do you get people excited, not just in the past, but also in the present? Is that your job?
It is our job. I think New York City's three airports aren't the highest rated in the United States. And one of our tasks was to create a real bright spot in the middle of JFK. And JFK itself is going through a very large and very expensive renovation to bring the whole airport up to that level. This is an amazing edifice to mid-century modern design. There's nothing else like it in the United States, nor in the world. And we want to make it as amazing as possible. If you'll take our hand, we'll chase your dream across the sky. For we can fly, up, up and away.
That was Ed Stocker, our man in New York there. He was reporting from the TWA Hotel at JFK in New York. And now, Joy of Joys, for the final part in our series of design on the changing face of our workplaces. We speak to Japanese industrial designer Naoto Fukasawa. Fukasawa is currently art director of Maruni Wood Industry, a Hiroshima-based furniture company. He also sits on the design advisory board of Muji, if you've heard of them. Daphne Karnesis caught up with Fukasawa recently. They started by talking about the increased prevalence and importance, dare we say, of wooden furniture in the working environment.
I think wood furniture used to be using in only at home, so that this kind of the handcrafted type of the chair and the furniture can be installed in the working environment as well too. So I think that's a great opportunity. It's not anymore kind of the clearly the kind of border and the separate the different industry, you know. So this is the kind of the situation now.
I wanted to ask you a bit about the role of technology in your work as well, and how you see it influencing you and how you leverage it in your work as well.
I think the result of the object, the product is still same in here, but the process of making is changed a bit, you know. It was a stamping or injection molding for mass production, but now it's like a handcraft technology. It can be more machinery, you know, to be produced many, many objects too. So I think its result is the same, but it's still, we could change quite a bit for that too. So.
And just finally, I mean, I know you work with brands from all over the world, and of course also with Japanese brands as well. How do you balance the kind of local versus global?
I'm a Japanese designer, but it's as well as the international designer as well. I describe myself as the soup maker at the broth makers. If I make a good soup, and each different country add some ingredients of a different taste to be making an even better different kind of the soup. So I'm not really so much focused different cultures, you know. I try to make basic things as high level, then add a different kind of taste on it.
That was Japanese industrial designer Naoto Fukasawa speaking to this show's very producer, Daphne Karnesis. Thanks, Daphne. Sadly, that's all we have time for on today's show, but don't miss us next week, where we challenge a cadre of young British architects to share their manifestos for the future. Don't forget, if you need a little more design-minded inspiration, you can always subscribe to this show or our sister podcast on Design Extra. How do we think of these names? That's available each Thursday. You can also pick up a copy of the latest issue of Monocle magazine at all self-respecting newsstands now. Monocle on Design was produced by Daphne Karnesis. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.